The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year. It's a particularly extraordinary year for us at Women of the Year because it's our 70th anniversary. So in celebration, we're doing something a bit different in this series of the podcast. Every woman who's invited to the Women of the Year lunch is extraordinary in some way. And we've been lucky enough to talk to some of them in the previous three series of The Extraordinary Ordinary. But back in 2000, it was decided to give awards to a small number of standout women at each lunch in recognition of their exceptional achievements, courage, and or legacy, or indeed all three. Since then, we've honoured over 100 amazing women, including Tina Turner, Margaret Thatcher, P.D. James, and Marie Colvin. But it hasn't just been about the famous names. We've also given awards to many extraordinary, ordinary women who've shown remarkable determination, bravery, tenacity, and courage, often in the most difficult and dangerous of situations. I'm Diane Kenwood, journalist, broadcaster, and a director of Women of the Year. And in this anniversary series, I'll be talking to some of those amazing past award winners to share why they were honoured, what it meant to them at the time, and to find out how life has been for them since becoming a Woman of the Year award winner. Our first guest in this series is also one of our earliest award winners. The very epitome of an extraordinary, ordinary woman, Pam Warren came to the public's attention in the most traumatic of circumstances as the worst affected victim of the catastrophic Paddington rail crash exactly 25 years ago. Pam suffered horrific burns from the fireball that ripped through her carriage, and after dozens of operations to repair her dreadfully damaged body, she became known as the woman in the mask, thanks to the plastic mask she had to wear to protect her face for over a year as it slowly healed. Determined to turn her trauma into something positive, Pam became an outspoken champion for improved passenger safety, challenging rail management executives and the government to ensure something like the disaster she had been a victim of could never happen again. We were thrilled to recognise her remarkable bravery and determination with a Woman of the Year award in 2001, and I'm delighted she's here today to talk to us about what life has been like for her since then. Pam, hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary.
Hello, Diane. And yes, I'm quite honoured to be called an extraordinary ordinary.
You are extraordinary in so many ways, so many. I can't believe it's been 25 years since that rail crash. It still seems so vivid to me, but I'm imagining that's nothing like what it must feel like for you.
I can sort of believe it is 25 years because it does feel like an awfully long time. And every time I look in the mirror in the morning and notice the new wrinkles, I know it's 25 years. But as you say, at the same time, it feels like it was almost yesterday, particularly because even though I have fully recovered from everything, I will always have post-traumatic stress disorder. So unfortunately, I still get very occasionally nightmares and flashbacks. So that's why I get a bit confused about time sometimes. But 25 years, yeah, it's a long time. But it is lovely from the point of view that when I'm out in public now, I just walk around thinking, well, I'm not going to get recognised anymore now. It's been long enough.
You did absolutely become the public face of this terrible, terrible disaster. And at a time when you were having to cope with enormous trauma in your own life from the effects and the damage it did to your body, what was it like to suddenly become this public figure?
Oh, it was frightening. It really was. I wasn't expecting it and nobody warned me. All I was doing was I was standing up for what I thought was right at the time. And it didn't occur to me, the attention, particularly because of the mask I drew back then. And I coped as best I could. And the first 5 years after the crash, so up to 2004, I was so busy with trying to get the railway safer for the UK that I sort of got used to the public attention and the media attention. And I used it, I hope, for the good, in as much as I used that attention to help me drive forward the campaign in order to get the government and the rail industry to do what they had promised. I think when the mask did come off, which was almost 2 years actually in the end, I then didn't expect people to recognise me. So again, I was doubly shocked when they were still coming up to me. And even by the 10th anniversary, I caught the train again. It was the first time I'd caught a train since Paddington had happened.
So 10 years you didn't go on a train?
No, I managed to avoid going on a train. I got driven everywhere, or I relied on friends to drive me places. But eventually I thought, I'm not going to let being frightened of the trains define me. I've just refused to stand there and be scared of something. So I forced myself to catch the train. And ever since then, yes, I do commute now. I don't like it. I don't enjoy it. But I will do it because it's convenient sometimes. So there's been a few times when somebody has come up to me on the train, or when I've been on the platform, they've come up and said, I remember you. And I'm always shocked, I must admit. But I think I made a conscious decision in 2005 to drop out of sight. Yes, I've come back occasionally because the media started looking for me at various anniversaries, like the 10th and then the 20th. But again, although we've hit the 25th one this year, I've actually hidden from the media as well, because I would prefer to be anonymous.
For people who might not remember it or might not even be aware of it, remind us, if you can, exactly what happened on that day 25 years ago.
I can. I might sound dispassionate, because it's the only way I can divorce my emotions away from the actual incident. But very quickly and generally, two trains, one heading out of Paddington and one heading into Paddington, collided at Ladbroke Grove at over 130 miles an hour. They're on the same piece of track. Back then, the fuel tanks were just underneath the engine, and I was in the carriage directly behind the engine coming from Reading into London. So the impact was so severe at such speed that the tanks exploded. And that's where the fireball came from and ripped through our carriage. And unfortunately, 36 people did die. I was supposed to be the 37th. My family was told I wouldn't make it. And yes, I was burnt. Still makes me shudder when I think back.
Thank you for sharing that and explaining that, because I recognise there may be people listening to this who were young enough that they weren't aware of the event.
Or weren't even born.
Weren't even born, exactly. The unimaginable trauma of it all to anybody listening and trying to imagine what it was like to go through is just unbearable. I wonder now, with the benefit of all this time, do you feel that you got the help and support you needed? You obviously got fantastic medical care, and I can see you now as we're talking and you look fabulous. But I wonder also, alongside all of that terrible physical trauma, the actual mental impact of something like that and what support you got to help you with that.
I'll be honest, I didn't get that much support, not from outside influences, for a long time. Again, nobody explained to us, while I was so severely physically injured, because that took a couple of years to get on top of, the mental side didn't really kick in until that second year. And by then, any help had evaporated. It was around straight after the crash, but unfortunately, the powers that be, or whoever organises these things, had pulled it away after 6 months. So I sort of fell through the cracks. It was when I started struggling with what I didn't know was PTSD. I was just behaving in a very strange way. My life was falling apart. I was deliberately doing things that I didn't understand, but it was going to destroy me. So I tried to commit suicide to make it all stop. And that's when my family then intervened and got me a psychiatrist and a psychologist. And it was them that really put me back on track to rebuilding my life and getting to grips with the PTSD. Because I'd been left for so long with no help, they said I was going to have it for the rest of my life. So it's been more a case of learning how to build your life around the PTSD so that you can still get on. And I've now got it to the stage, because I've still got a psychiatrist and a psychologist, even after all these years, but I only turn to them when I know I need help. But they have been wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And without them, I don't think I would have made it. But because I have, I think it's so valuable if somebody's struggling that they're not too frightened to stand up and say, actually, I do need help. There shouldn't be all this taboo around, oh, I don't need a psychiatrist, or no, I'm not going crazy. There's no judgment on the person that it's happening to. It's more a case of, look, if you want to rebuild your life and make this a positive rather than a negative, you are going to need some outside help.
Do you think that does still exist? I feel that we've certainly moved on a lot since those days when what you experienced and subsequently the completely understandable mental ramifications of that to you. Nowadays, you'd be absolutely, that would be entirely expected. And actually, you know, reaching out for help, you shouldn't even have had to reach out for it. It should have been, it should absolutely have been there, and it should have been recognised. I feel that there is more recognition of that, and people are less sort of badly regarded if they say they need help. But do you think that's still something that carries some kind of taboo around it?
In a way, I think, yes, you're right. We are far more open about things and people are far more willing to talk about it. I think we're far more willing to talk about the problem, but the access to getting the help or people knowing where they can go or how to reach the professionals, that's not quite so clear cut. I think that's still a bit up in the air. That still needs to be made easier.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, absolutely. I think the stigma is beginning to be rightly removed, but you're quite right when you say I still think a lot of people don't know how to go about getting the help they need. I mean, clearly, absolutely everything about your life changed on that one dreadful day. You were a successful businesswoman before it, but you have also said that it wasn't a very good life before the crash, and what you decided you needed to do was make life better afterwards. Why did you feel it wasn't good before, and how did you focus yourself on the direction you wanted to take to make it better?
I always refer to myself as pre-crash Pam now and post-crash Pam, because pre-crash Pam, I don't think I would have liked her if I met her, to be perfectly frank. I was a result of the conditioning we had. So I was into my career. I wanted to make money. If I had a one-bed flat, I then needed a two-bed flat, and then I needed a house. I needed the latest cars. I wanted to go on five-star type holidays. And my family were very low down on the list. So they were lucky if they saw me once a year back then. And yes, I worked all the hours that God sent, but it was very much all about the money. What I realised during the crash was, well, I can't take it with me. I just had this feeling I've done something wrong. I've got so much potential within myself and I haven't realised it properly. Now, my recovery took 10 years in total. So that sort of slowed me down. But during that time, I had plenty of time to think. So I was able to then think, okay, well, what do I want my life to look like after this? My primary focus was family and friends. So it had to be caring about people, loving people, being there to help other people. Now, yes, you occasionally get caught out because not everybody is a good person, but I would much prefer to be this way and get hurt occasionally rather than close myself off from anyone. So that became my primary focus. And then because I'm not the type to sit around and do lunch or just do nothing, I then had to very much focus on, okay, I know I don't want to go back to the money trap. So what do I want my life to look like moving forward on this? And I realised a huge thing about me. I get bored quite easily. If I get bored, I then misbehave.
Right.
This is just something I've learned over the years. So I now don't stick to one thing. So I've actually as of today, I've got 6 projects going in very different spheres, all heading off in different directions. But to me, that's exciting. I enjoy doing that.
One of the things you did take on doing, which anyone else would be entirely forgiven for absolutely not, was becoming this very vociferous campaigner. You absolutely stuck your head above the parapet and really fought for what you believed needed to be done to ensure that rail safety was improved and a disaster like the one you experienced couldn't happen again. That's a lot to take on when you're going through such an enormous process of physical and mental recovery yourself.
It was, but I've always, ever since a child, I've always had this sense of injustice. If I see an injustice, there's something in me that goes, right, Pam, if you can do something about it, you're going to do it. I don't ever question that. And even though I dropped out of the public eye back in 2005, I'm still involved with the rail industry, but I'm doing it very quietly in the background on a safety committee, quite high up within the industry, so that I'm keeping an eye on what's going on as time moves on. And I wouldn't feel right not doing that. But I approached every single project I do like that. If I see somebody that's being taken advantage of or downtrodden or something's wrong, I get annoyed. If I can't do something about it, I'm sort of cheering on the people that are doing something. But if I can do something about it, I tend to get into the fray.
Nothing that you've experienced has quashed that fierce sense of fighting for what you believe to be right, which is absolutely brilliant. And obviously one of the things that we recognised you for at Women of the Year. I wonder what you remember about the day of the lunch and how it felt to you to win the award and what it meant to you to win the award at the time.
It came out of the blue at me. So I was shocked. I could not believe that this august body of women had sat down and decided that I deserved that award. I really couldn't. So it was really humbling. And at the same time, and this was deep down, I mean, I kept it to myself, it was confirmation to me that I was on the right path, because it was almost like I was getting quiet approval that, yes, Pam, you're hurt, and yes, you are standing up and you're fighting for what you believe in, but we are 100% behind you. So that's how it felt. I don't know who nominated me, still don't to this day, but thank you, whoever it was. I don't remember much of the day clearly because I was still on morphine back then. So everything in life was a bit fuzzy. But I do remember meeting some wonderful women during the luncheon. Everyone was so kind. I remember meeting Claire Balding. She and I had a long chat. Moira Stewart, because my hands were so burnt, I couldn't turn the pages of the speech I prepared when I was accepting the award. So she was kindly turning the pages. And subconsciously, I was going, oh my God, Moira Stewart, the news broadcaster. And then every time you did things like, if you went to go to the loo, you'd bump into another amazing woman. And it was almost overwhelming. I felt like, well, I shouldn't be here. What am I doing here? I don't understand this. But it was a wonderful day.
I'm glad that you found the event so inspiring and uplifting. And absolutely at the heart of what we do at Women of the Year is to champion and celebrate remarkable women who are doing truly extraordinary things. Do you look back now at what has happened to you and recognise that what you've survived and what you have done and what you've achieved since then is remarkable?
I don't look at it as remarkable, but I do look back with pride. I've always promised myself that next time I have to meet my maker, whatever that or whoever that may be, I want to be able to look back on my life and said, I did my best and it was fun. That's what I want my last words to be going through my head as I expire. So, yes, I'm proud of what I've done. I also know I'm not done yet. So I know that there's more I need to do and achieve and go for to not so much improve my life. I'm actually now in a very good place and I'm comfortable, and my need for stuff is material stuff is no longer there. So I'm fairly content, and I could sit here and just carry on and live out the rest of my days in peaceful contentment. But again, there's too much that goes on where you think, no, I need to be out there and I need to be helping. So now I feel very much I want to help people achieve what they want to do, provided it's in their way extraordinary.
I know that great things will continue to happen for you, Pam, because of the sort of person you are, and that, you know, the change you've brought about in your life and the changes that you have subsequently helped other people bring about in their lives is truly remarkable. It is. I'm so delighted that we've managed to get together and have this conversation and catch up after all this time. But I can't let you go, obviously, without asking you the four questions that we ask all our guests on The Extraordinary Ordinary. And the first one of those is, who is or are the woman or women who've inspired you?
Okay, I'm going to do this quickly in two parts, because there's two women from history. I'm quite a history buff that inspire me. And they are Anne Boleyn and Marie Antoinette. Now, the reason I've always held them in high esteem is not because I don't know that much, or I do know about their lives, but only what you read in history books. All the historians agreed that when they were put on trial, both of them, they were able to stand up for what they thought was right, and they eloquently put themselves across to a system that was completely stacked against them. And that I find truly inspiring. I love women that can do that. And then more present day, you'll recognise this name, but I miss her. And I do think about her often, is Marie Colvin.
Oh, yes. She's another attendee at the lunch, somebody else we've honoured at the lunch in the past. She was amazing, wasn't she? Tell me about what it is about her that particularly inspires you.
Well, we met at the Women of the Year luncheon.
Ah, there you go.
And the lovely thing was, because I was a bit overwhelmed by the end of it, I was sat outside on the bench and she came and sat down with me and we got chatting. And just, we clicked. There was something about our personalities that clicked. And we stayed in touch afterwards. So we became not close friends, but we became friendly, should I say. And then, I don't know, she was just so inspiring. She went for what she truly believed in. She stood up for what she felt was right. And unfortunately, of course, she died doing what she felt was right. And I remember when we heard about her death in Syria, I was absolutely devastated. I mean, my first reaction was I messaged her family and, you know, said how much. So I admire enormously. And as I said, even to this day, I mean, she died, what, back in 2012, I believe. She still pops into my head. And there are occasions when I'm doing something and I'll go, what would Marie do?
Isn't it wonderful when you meet your heroines and they are every bit as spectacular as you imagine they will be?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm just thankful, because if it hadn't been for you guys, I would never have met her.
Well, it's our huge pleasure. Question number two, Pam, what advice would you give your younger self?
That was fairly simple. Don't stress about the small stuff and don't stress about the big stuff. In as much as I've actually developed this, every time something happens, I've got three things that pop instantly into my head, which is anyone hurt? Has anyone died? And is there anything I can do about it? If the answer is no, I now push it away. If the answer is yes, then I'll get involved. And it has removed so much stress from my life, particularly with everything that's going on in the world today. But there's nothing I can do about 90% of it. So again, there's no point in stressing.
Oh, that's brilliant. I'm so going to remember that, because you're absolutely right. So often we feel overwhelmed with the worry of so many things that we absolutely can't do a single thing about or control. And that's a brilliant set of criteria. I love that. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Question number three. What's one thing you can't live without?
Animals. I have three cats. Now, I'm not a mad cat woman. The third one was a mistake.
But you have a cat that's a mistake. I would like you to explain that.
She was going begging and nobody wanted her, so I took her on. Anyway, the reason I couldn't live life, I love all animals, dogs, horses, things like that. However, I went for cats myself simply because they're so independent. And I love the fact that they just look at you and, as if you're a piece of dirt. But you still do what they want. And plus, because I travel a lot with my speaking, the cats can look after themselves, whereas a dog would pine or whatever. So, but I now live in North Wales, so I'm surrounded by countryside. So I've got sheep around. I've now got friends who've got horses. I'm getting involved with the donkey sanctuary. You know, it's all this sort of stuff. I go walking with a friend and her dogs. Couldn't live life without animals. I love animals.
Oh, fantastic. I would say you're owned by three cats.
I'm owned by three, yes.
And the last question, Pam. What's something about you that would surprise people to know?
People won't believe this, but I am painfully shy.
Oh.
Yeah, I have been since a child. Now, when people see me on stage or when I'm doing something like this interview, I can sort of rise to the task and do it. But again, if, for example, you were new to me and said, how about going out for a coffee? I would actually start feeling a bit unwell because I'd be then really frightened, because then I'd be going, well, am I good enough? Or you know, what would I talk about and all this sort of stuff? And that will probably live with me. But I do seem to have this talent of, if you like, putting on a metaphorical mask, doing what I need to do. And sometimes it's important because you're trying to pass on information. But at home, I tend to be very quiet. I'm a very quiet individual.
Well, we're delighted you weren't quiet today, Pam, and thank you for being brave enough to say yes to coming on the podcast and to being so fantastically open and inspiring as you are. We were delighted to celebrate you way back in 2001. We're delighted that your life is as content as it is, and I wish you all the very best with all the projects that you have coming up. Don't get bored. We certainly weren't for a single second. Pam, thank you so much for being on The Extraordinary Ordinary with us.
Many thanks, Diane. And may I wish all of you a happy 70th anniversary.
Thank you.
The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. CCEP is the world's largest independent bottler. In Great Britain, they make, move and sell soft drinks for every occasion, and employ some 3,600 people across England, Scotland and Wales at manufacturing sites, offices and depots. At CCEP, their everyone's welcome philosophy means they're creating a modern company where everyone can grow, develop and belong. They make a positive difference in both their workplaces and their local communities, which is something they're extremely passionate about at CCEP. If you've enjoyed this episode of The Extraordinary Ordinary, which of course we really hope you have, please rate and review us. It helps people to find us. Thank you.